Hi, so welcome to the LS, the virtual LSE. Thank you for joining us on this glorious evening. My name's Neil Lee. I'm a professor of economic geography at the London School of Economics and an associate of the International Inequalities Institute, which is hosting this event. I'll be chairing today's event. Today's event, we're going to be talking about Dan Bresnitz's new book, which is, I think, a timely and very important work. And it's important because cities and regions across the world will be looking at how they can rebuild their economies, how they can sort of build back better in the aftermath of COVID. And I think Dan's book does a really good job of telling us, how that can happen. So his new book, Innovation in Real Places: Strategies for Prosperity in an Unforgiving World, what it does is it sort of challenges some of the sort of orthodox models of economic development. So we talk a little bit about San Francisco and the sort of Bay Area and the sort of Silicon Valley model. And essentially, Dan's book is based on a more nuanced, more evidence-based, and a less boosterist view of the world and about how sort of local communities can essentially, if I can use the phrase, take back control in some sort of more meaningful sense. So let me introduce Dan. Professor Dan Bresnitz is co-director of the Innovation Policy Lab and the Monck Chair of Innovation Studies at the University of Toronto. He's the program director of the Innovation Equity and the Future Program at CIFA, and he's going to start off today's webinar by giving us an outline of the arguments in his book. Now, following this, we have two stellar respondents who are going to be talking about the book and about their sort of views on these questions. First of all, we're going to have Vijaya Alexsan. So Vijaya is chief executive of Power to Change, which is one of the UK's one of the UK's most interesting sort of, I guess, community business foundations at the moment. But she's also one of the UK's most interesting, well, throughout sort of the last decade, she's been one of the UK's most interesting and I think original voices on, well, economic development and sort of, local communities. Now, I know Vijaya because we used to work in think tanks together. And so I haven't told her this, but it became a, so I worked in one think tank and she worked in another. And it became a running joke in my team that every time I came up with an idea for some research to do, about 2 weeks later, Vijaya's team would produce something which was better and sort of, ahead of the game and all that. So I'm sort of delighted to have her here. She's also LSE alumni, so that's wonderful. So we're very, very pleased to have her here, and thank you very much for coming. And then we also have Professor David Soskis, who's going to be the second respondent. And David is an extremely well known, a very famous political economist, as I'm sure many of you know. And he's going to be the second respondent. He's a professor of political science and economics at the Department of Government and an International Inequalities Institute affiliate. So Dan's going to start off, then there will be respondents, and then there will be plenty of time for questions afterwards. But before I hand over to Dan, I just need to tell you, I just need to give a sort of shameless plug for our next set of events at the International Inequalities Institute. So we have the final inequality seminar of Lent term tomorrow, and that is anonymous growth incidence curves in the United States between 1968 and 2016 with Professor Francois Bourguignon, who's Emeritus Professor of Economics at the PSE. That's going to be chaired by Professor Francisco Ferreira, who's the Amartya Sen Professor of Inequality Studies and the Director of the III. Following the Easter break, we have some more events coming up. We have, on the 26th of April, the III is co-hosting Debating Capital and Ideology with Professor Thomas Piketty from the Paris School of Economics and ES. And then after that, we have, on Wednesday, 28th of April, Professor Amartya Sen, amongst others, is going to be talking about Mary Wollstonecraft and the vindication of human rights. So, with no further ado from me, I will hand over to Dan. Thank you very much for joining us, and we're very much looking forward to hearing about your book.
Thank you, Neil. What I'll do now is first, I like to stand up when I present. I thought that this it's a nicer way, and I will also share my screen. And thank you so much for having me here. As I told you and David and Dina, you're very brave because this is the very, very first time I'm presenting this book and trying to present a book in 30 to 40 minutes is always a challenge. So what I thought that I'll do in this presentation is very briefly, the book is basically divided into three parts. So setting the problem, explaining how the world works, then what can we do about it, And the third is what I call the dysfunctionals, meaning the really important things that as a local leader, maybe even as a president of the United States, there is nothing you can do about, but you need to know and you need to gain. What I'll do today is focus mainly on part one and two, and then depending on the response and the questions, we can talk about the rest. So first of all is the reason I started to write this book. And this book is aimed for people who want to do something, not just for us academics. And I started it because I got really frustrated about the debates and discussions about innovation and why should we care about it. So first I want to remind us all, why should we care about innovation? And we should care about innovation, not because it's an invention, not because I can come up with new high-tech gadget. And innovation is the actual act of taking an idea and putting it into reality. In economic terms, of course, it's putting it in the market. It is the action encompassing the complete process from coming with an idea to improving the after sales services. It's taking new ideas to the market. It is improving them, improving the products and the services, and coming all stages from vision to design, development, production, sale, users, and after sales. And it is impactful because it's continuous, not because it's a breakthrough. We just had COVID-19, you might have noticed, and that's why I'm talking to you through on the streaming. It's not enough that we came, as the world has shockingly discovered, it's not enough that we came with a vaccine. We actually need to put the vaccine into use all around the globe. And that's exactly why innovation and the continuous part of innovation matter. It is not enough that I come with an idea. It's not even enough that I put it to use for a few people. It is the fact that we spend millions of hours on engineering every year on improving our cars, on improving our CPUs, on improving the memory. Otherwise, this a smartphone would still be a wooden box here and it will take me 5 minutes to make a phone call. It also is then critical to remember who actually innovates in the economy. And there are in reality only two agents that innovate: individuals, which we like to call them entrepreneurs, and companies. Therefore, if you want to have more innovation, economic innovation, technological innovation in your society, you need to change the behavior of those two agents, with all due respect to us academics, to venture capitalists, to whatever. If you don't change the behavior of those two agents, you do a lot of stuff, but you don't do innovation policy. Now, it is important, of course, because innovation-based growth is the only way to achieve long-term sustained prosperity. And yet, because of that promise, worldwide, you had trillions of dollars wasted blindly on copying Silicon Valley of venture-backed startups, you know, where you put a huge amount of money basically on a cheap company in order to sell that company, who cares about technology, for a lot of money. It is almost impossible to imitate Silicon Valley. There's a lot about why in the book, but you can just look at the reality. Since Silicon Valley became Silicon Valley, maybe three more places became Silicon hyphen. Further, much more importantly, is the Silicon Valley model, and we'll talk about it briefly, leads to growing inequality. So the question is, why would any sane policy or community leader would even want her community to look like Silicon Valley is beyond me, but yet we're spending trillions of dollars. So question is, are there other models? Can you create local growth, which is what usually local leaders care about and what people actually cares about? I mean, I love the fact that there's so many millions out of poverty in China and India, but if Toronto comes crashing down, I much more care about that. So is there a way to create local growth and prosperity without a flourishing what we call high-tech industry? And can innovation-based growth create local prosperity as well as wealth? I mean, it's great that my friends have become, many of them actually, have become millionaires, but does it create also prosperity for all of us? And is it a dichotomy which seems to have happened, is that it's either high tech or you bring manufacturing back? I mean, my beloved friends to the South had a president called Trump until very recently that claims to make America great again. You have Boris, I'm not going to comment on that, but is it only those two options? And my argument that it is completely untrue. And if you want to understand how to have local innovation-based growth currently, we have to understand that there is an evolving economic globalization, which truly changed how innovation translates to economic growth, for whom and where. And the one thing that is truly new in our supposedly new globalization is how the production of both services and goods are now globally fragmented. So this is, for example, an iPhone. And on the back, it has two sort of quasi-lies. It claims it's designed in California and it is manufactured in China. The reality is it's designed and produced all over and final assembly usually in China and then sold all over. And you can go industry by industry and see how it has changed. So one industry that I love to do research on is semiconductors. And if you think about the semiconductor industry and you start to think about places, so Silicon Valley, Tel Aviv, Seoul, Taipei, Shenzhen, all of them have really successful semiconductors industries. And yet what they do in each place, sometimes even the same companies, is completely different. In Silicon Valley, in Tel Aviv, for example, they do a high-end novel product innovation, meaning they try to put new ideas on silicon. In Taiwan, they take those blueprints and make them into actual silicon fiber. And in Seoul, for example, in Korea, you'll see that they really control niches of semiconductors. So for example, this phone, the company that makes the most profit from iPhones is Apple. The second highly profitable company is Samsung, with Qualcomm just behind. So what you really start to need to think about as innovation is not necessarily industries, but what set of activities you want to have in your local community. And that's real choices, because each of them also has a significant distributional difference. And to make things easier, there's the best way of thinking about it is to think about it as four distinct stages of production. And excelling in each of those stages necessitate different innovational capacities and leads to very different distribution and long-term prosperity. And what I'll do now is very briefly just run you through the stages. So the stage one, which we are completely obsessed with, as if there is no other innovation on earth, is novelty, the coming up with new ideas and new technologies. I harassed Silicon Valley enough, so let me talk about Tel Aviv, because people think that Israel is a case of unmitigated success in high tech. So let me tell you the case of the good, the bad, and I think it's not ugly, just plainly sad. So first of all, the miracle. It's 68, which is the reason I'm saying 68 is because it's the first time that Israel even bothered to gather statistics on R&D. And in that time, basically, it had less R&D workers with academic education in the whole industrial sector than one building of LSE when LSE will be opened, 886. From 78 to 86, you had raging inflation. This is not a spelling mistake. It is more than 100,000%. If you just think about the name of a currency, you can see that. It used to be the lira, the pound, the Israeli pound. It then moved to the shekels, and in less than 10 years was changed again. They were so innovative and they ran out of names, so we just called it the new Israeli shekels. Yet, by 2000, from basically having zero R&D, Israel was the lowest in the OECD, Israel moved to, within 32 years, the export of just IT were 30 billion, which was 71% of all industrial exports, and 70% of all GDP growth came just from startups. So really the high tech, mainly ICT, became the engine of growth. The largest number of high tech firms on NASDAQ, after the US, of course, and the highest R&D intensity in the world. As David can tell you, those statistics are very iffy, but Israel was between number one and number four, which are basically equivalent, for over 20 years now. Moving again from a point where there was, in reality, zero R&D in the industry. Yet, on the same, and this leads to all those wonderful companies which you probably never heard about. Checkpoint, you might have heard because they invented the firewall. Waze, you might use. Seva, you might not know, but it's one of the biggest suppliers of IP, IPR, that's what they sell, like Qualcomm, if you ever want to do your own semiconductors. And Wix is if you want to have, it's basically the Israeli Shopify. A lot of those companies in Israel have hundreds of them. Consumers don't even know that they exist. Yet, on the side of this wonderful miracle, and it really is a miracle, you have the left behind us. So in 68, apart from the fact that Israel had no R&D workers, it was also the second most egalitarian economy in the greater OECD. In 2021, today, Israel is the second most unequal in the OECD. And as a matter of fact, one out of every five households in Israel is under the poverty line. And indeed, nothing else but startups and R&D centers, multinational, actually works in the Israeli economy. You can go sector by sector in the private business sector. And once you get out of ICT and ICT R&D and health R&D, all other sectors in the same years you have this miracle are either productivity is either stagnant or lowering down, leading to that dual economy where very few people having the best of Silicon Valley and New York Stock Exchange life, one of out of every five is below the poverty line, and the rest are much closer to the poverty line than to the great life of Silicon Valley. And yet, somehow, every city on earth is claiming that they want to be Silicon Haifa, Silicon Valley of the North, Silicon Wadi, Silicon Isle, whatever, which I think is a question, if we care about innovation and local economic growth, that we should wonder about why. So even if you can imitate Silicon Valley, why would you want that on your community? So our question is, do you have other models? And I love PowerPoint. And I would say that yes, depending on the stages. So there's a second stage, which is design, prototype development, and production engineering. So it's wonderful to come with those new ideas for products and everything else. Somebody actually then have to design them into the real world. You might hear a lot if you look at the ICT and the high tech industries about a company called IDEO from Silicon Valley. What is interesting in IDEO, apart from the fact that it designed almost every handheld design machine you ever had, is that it mostly run by people coming from manufacturing, real manufacturing experience. And an even better example, and the one I want to use for a whole community that actually thrives, is from Italy. So this is indeed the North. And here I want to give thanks to my former postdoc and now a professor in Ireland, Giulio Buccini, who introduced me to this area. This is the Veneto. This is just above Venezia. And what you have there is the cluster that make your dream shoes, dream high-end luxury woman footwear shoes into reality. So unlike what you might think if you watch reality TV and see those wonderful, weird designers, very creative designer, work for a day and boom, you have a wonderful shoe. Usually, when people buy shoes for thousands of euros, they want the shoe to actually work, meaning that it has to be put on a foot. Somebody has to walk on it. There's that thing called sweat and leather and all those other issues. You also need to produce it for a few thousand a year, at least at a certain price point. If you want all those things to happen, the place you go in the world to make it happen up to production is Brenta. Because in Brenta came a unique ecosystem, including a school, including financing, including a whole supply network, which is focusing on the innovational capacities that allows Brenta's firms and Brenta as a whole to take those designs and make them into real shoes and actually produce them. And as many clusters in Italy, for example, went down, Brenta, by focusing on this stage two, is actually thriving. And again, and then I want to repeat that, you need completely different innovational capacities and skills. You need different role for policymakers of how to enact all those local firms and also connect them with the globe. You need different educational systems. You need obviously different financial systems because those companies really don't need venture capital. And what you get in exchange is very widespread prosperity with good jobs for a wide array of different skill sets. Unlike Tel Aviv, we are not talking about only high-end R&D engineers from the best universities on earth, but you talk about a whole array of societies with its different skills getting high quality jobs based on constant innovation. Stage three is second generation production and component innovation. Remember what I told you, that a lot of economic growths happen because of you have continuous innovation. This continuous innovation, once you've fragmented the production, also comes in the component, and also comes with the whole idea of how to actually produce this stuff. I don't know how many of you know, but currently the US, the big US, is begging a Taiwanese company called TSMC's, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, to open facilities in Arizona because the US firms no longer know how to compete in manufacturing IC chips and system on chips. So maybe Silicon Valley comes with great new ideas to put them on silicon. American companies don't know how to actually fabricate it in a competitive way. And that's where Taiwan, and especially Taipei and another city, has come into play. You had, in the book, I'm talking about two different industries, semiconductors, and the other is bicycles. I don't know how many of you use bikes today, but one of the things you might notice, if you remember, as a child, I'd buy a bike. It would be unbelievably heavy and cumbersome. Right now, the bikes that you buy are a lot lighter, somewhat cheaper, a lot stronger, and people, normal people like me, can actually think about mountain biking. And the reason is a lot of material science that went between a public research organization called ITRI and a company called Giants Manufacturing, which completely transformed the biking industry. And right now, Giant is producing
up to $2 billion worth of great jobs and bikes for its small community in Taiwan. In the ICT, basically the same model, E3, the big public research organization, would go figure out how to develop new technologies in semiconductor manufacturing and design, and then spend them off to the private market. And you have companies from TSMC's to the MediaTek's and Hynix. If you buy a smartphone from any company which is not Apple or Samsung, you probably have a MediaTek inside, which is basically the brain. It's the Taiwanese Qualcomm. So all the Chinese companies actually produce and design their phones around a MediaTek platform. And the same goes for Hynix. I don't know how many of you remember the Google Glass. The Google Glass was based around the Hynix chipset. And they chose Hynix not because Hynix was, you know, high-end Silicon Valley, because it produced reliable, working, constantly improving chipset for a glass that you actually wanted to sell for people at a price which they can afford. And again, we're talking about different innovational capacity. You need to know how to constantly improve second generation production, how to improve semiconductor fabrication and all the tools that allow you to get those designs from all over the world and translate them to real chips. You have a division of labor within a huge public research institution and the industry, who does the research and who does the development. They are called venture capitals, but are completely different financial institution in Taiwan. You have a completely different relationship with the global industry. And the result is a widespread prosperity, good jobs for a wide array of different skill sets. And if you look at all the figures we like about innovation, like the number of patents per capita, R&D intensity in the economy, all the rest, Taiwan is actually competing with Israel almost to the same level, maybe sometimes even more. And yet, unlike Israel, that moved from being very equal to very highly unequal, Taiwan equality actually improved. And it is not clear that if I'm a baby not knowing what my skills and how much I have in my bank account when I'm born in this world, it is not at all clear that I should not prefer to be born Taiwanese than Israeli or even an American. Last but not least is stage four, production and assembly. And what is interesting, I once wrote a whole book about China and innovation. What was always interesting for me is that the most innovative companies, especially in ICT and especially in telecommunication, did not appear in Beijing and Shanghai next to wonderful universities. They appeared in Shenzhen and Dongguan, what me and my co-author, Michael Mefera, used to call Dongzhen, which is that area right next to Hong Kong, where until very recently there was no universities, no research institution. The innovation came from actually understanding how to make and build those tools. And yet, right now, if you want a drone, you probably are buying things from a Shenzhen company. If you want a smartphone, you definitely are buying something that was produced in Shenzhen. Tencent, almost Huawei, of course, ZTE, all of those companies coming from Shenzhen. All of them have their innovation capacities based around the fact that they really know how to take all those components, figuring out the enough innovation that make them slightly better for their consumers, and the real innovation how to produce them. And some of them have already left in the dust the ability of foreign companies to compete. Fifth generation telecommunication is a case in point. And yes, I am fully aware that I am repeating myself. But again, you have different innovational capacity. In order to succeed in that, and for example, being able to produce iPhones, being able to create a system where you have in one location multiple, as in sometimes hundreds of lines, each one working on a different product, which is the very first time you produce it in the world, and then changing it almost immediately, moving up and down in the level of how many of them you produce, needs an immense level of innovation that then translates to those things that you see, like the drones and smartphones. You have very different role for policymakers. You have very different education system. You really don't have research universities playing any part in the growth of this industry. Very different financial systems, completely different node if you think about the production of all those things until the final consumer of what happened in Shenzhen compared to Silicon Valley, and widespread prosperity and good jobs for a wide array of different skill sets. So I hope that I've done just by briefly showing you those stages from novel production to design to second generation innovation to production assembly, is that you need significant amount of innovation to excel in any of them. And each one, but they're very different set of innovation. And in each one of them, your decision to focus on that stage, A, is a real choice and a decision, and you can do that. And second, the impact of if you're successful on your local society is completely different. What I will say when you think about it, and I talk about it a lot in the book, but I suspect that I'm slowly but surely running out of time, is that there are four fundamentals that you have to think about. When you start to think about, okay, I'm Manchester, I'm Leicester, I'm Hamilton, Ontario, I want to have an innovation-based growth. You need to think about, A, what is indeed the skills that you have, the facilities you have, the capabilities you have. You need to figure out what is it, why do I want innovation-based growth? Why do I want to spend all my taxpayers' money on making this happen? Do I really want high inequality, or I want innovation in order to secure long-term prosperity for my community, not for the globe? And when you do that, you need to figure out what kind of flows of local, global knowledge, demand, and inputs you need to have. How do you supply and create public and semi-public goods? So, for example, different skills, different roles for what we might call universities, different set of financing. How you organize all this into an ecosystem that actually, and again, remember, there's only two agents of innovation that reinforce firm level, entrepreneurial level benefits of working in those stages. And of course, what happens in all those places is the co-evolution. If you think about the story of Israel that I told you in the beginning, the role for public policy in the Tel Aviv story was critical. Was completely different when there was no R&D engineers than to the time now, where Israel is top of the line globally in terms of R&D intensity and number of IPOs on NASDAQ. You cannot have the same innovation policy tools you had in 68, 73, even the 80s, and expect that they will work as well and to 2021. With that, what I'll do is stop. Here are my contact. If anyone wants to email me or anything, I'm sure Neil can also share them with you.
That's wonderful stuff, Dan. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over to Vidya in a minute, but I just want to highlight the fact that if you want to, you can type in questions in the Q&A, and we've had a few questions already, but it would be great to get some questions for all three panelists in a little while. So Vijaya, thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much. And thanks Neil for the opportunity to be part of the event this evening. So first, I mean, huge congratulations to you, Dan, on a really, really excellent book. And it's no mean feat to write a book that can bring the complex questions of innovation policy to life for the average reader. And as the non-professor on the panel this evening, I count myself among that category of average reader. And you've done that with such aplomb. The details in the book, the examples that you draw on kind of pay tribute to years and years of research and travel. I mean, the book crisscrosses the globe in a wonderful way. And I particularly love the Wizard of Oz quotes. And I will leave that out there for those of you who haven't read the book. I've not read a book, a popular economic science book like this that starts each chapter with Wizard of Oz quotes. So that in itself is something worth looking out for. So in my remarks, I want to focus on the aspects of the argument of the book that I found most compelling. Just present one example from my own work in the social economy that I found interesting in light of having read the book. I've never really thought about it in this context of a focus for a particular area, but I think it's quite interesting. And then finally consider what this means for what Dan's book and these concepts of innovation policy mean for the UK. So first to the book, I suppose what I realise now is I'm increasingly a localist, and that's perhaps not surprising given the work that I do supporting community-led businesses across England. And one of the things that came out really strongly for me from the book is the critical importance of places and communities making decisions for themselves about how their economies move forward and what their conception of growth is and how they deliver on that. And I particularly like the idea that I felt came out very strongly in the book of there being different conceptions of growth. I think we often don't appreciate that because we're all captured by that Silicon Valley concept of growth. And I found that incredibly powerful, and it felt like a centrally important argument to the book. And I think one that presents challenges for us here in the UK, which I'll come back to. I'm also a really big fan of the myth-busting element of the book, and Dan's taken us through some of that, but the differentiation right at the very beginning between invention and innovation, which we get also like incredibly caught up in, is critical. And I particularly appreciated, and we heard some of that in Dan's presentation of the book, the myth-busting around the potential of high-tech startups to support growth in places, when in fact, what the book reveals very strongly is that strategy is more likely to increase inequality. And a lot of my work focuses on many of the least prosperous places in England. So places, for those of you who know the UK, like Grimsby and Hartlepool. And I'm constantly struck by how few answers we seem to have for those sorts of places about how they improve their productivity, how they address growth. What are the options that they can look to that are regenerative of their local economy rather than extractive? And I thought it was interesting that Andy Haldane, the chief economist at the Bank of England, wrote last week that we need to be more focused on innovation in the foundation economy to support productivity improvements that areas like Grimsby and Hartlepool need. And very little thinking, to my mind, seems to be done about these critical parts of the economy. And so I really appreciated the book's wide view on what innovation is and that takes in these much broader elements of innovation than we often think of when we talk about innovation. And third, I particularly like the focus on the ecosystem needed to support innovation in place and the role of policy in growing, supporting and adapting that ecosystem. And I think in our general mindset of the economy, we neglect the breadth of that collaborative ecosystem that needs to be put in place to enable firms and individuals to thrive at any point in the innovation process. And as Dan has shown in the slides, you know, that encompasses the education system, you know, parts of the planning system around where people live. Are these places attractive for people to live in? Are people going to come to support that, the firm and entrepreneur level innovation that's needed? So I really like that sense that this requires that sort of that ecosystem underpinning things. Which brings me to Liverpool City Region as an interesting example of how a place that I'm very familiar with and have worked with extensively is trying to develop its economy and its own conception of what good looks like for its citizens and identify a competitive advantage in an area of the economy that would not traditionally be considered in thinking about recovery and growth. So Liverpool City Region has an ambition to become the country's most inclusive economy, in part because it continues to have significant challenges of inequality within the different boroughs of the region. So many of you will know the city of Liverpool, but there are five avoiding it that are much less successful economically, and it has consistently low productivity, even in England. So for historic and cultural reasons, it has a competitive advantage in terms of the social economy. So businesses that trade in order to deliver social benefit first and foremost. The region has a density of these kinds of businesses, particularly in the city itself, has seen strong growth in this area over the last decade or so, and also has a high number of visible entrepreneurs in that particular sector. So over the last 3 or 4 years, we at Power to Change have partnered with the city region to try to provide some of the support, some of that ecosystem needed to develop and continue to grow this part of the social economy. In part, that's been the development of a new financing vehicle, which is called Kindred, which has just launched, that can provide appropriate finance to these businesses at different life stages. There's also been investment in greater networking between these social businesses so they can provide each other with support, form supply chains and various other connections. And this is obviously not a globally traded part of the economy, so the nature of the ecosystem is slightly different from some of the examples that Dan's given, but we're quite intentionally trying to create this ecosystem to support the social economy. And much as the book describes the need for that ecosystem to adapt, I mean, in the very short period of the last 12 months with COVID, we've seen the need to change the support that's being offered. So the financing vehicle that we set up has already in 12 months had to adapt its finance offer to better respond to the changed circumstances. So rather, not even kind of within a decade, just within the space of 12 months, we've had to change things. So the social economy isn't an exclusive strategy for the whole city region, but in many parts of Liverpool city region, supporting the growth of locally rooted small businesses, which is largely what makes up the social economy, who will reinvest back into the local communities in which they're based, is, I think, an important route to greater community wellbeing and the kind of growth that will really benefit the people who live in that part of the country. And so why does this matter? This is what the last thing I wanted to touch on. This is a book about innovation policy, and it's a brilliant book about innovation policy. But for me, it's about something more critical than that. It's about the strategies for supporting growth in places outside of those places that dominate our conversations, which tend to be our major cities. And in developed countries, I think we all are very aware that we face real challenges in how we improve the quality of life in these places and restart growth, particularly post-COVID. But we're also very conscious, I think, as of late, of the consequences of not addressing this. I think those consequences are clear for everyone to see. Growing polarisation in our society, you've seen those who feel left behind and those who have benefited from prosperity, the growth of populist politics. And we all saw in January this year what that can lead to in terms of the storming of the US Capitol. But anyone living in the UK right now recognises these risks all too well, I think. Underpinning the culture wars that we see day to day is an economic challenge, not just a social and cultural one. And it feels to me that the lessons for policymakers in this book are more critical than they might at first seem when you think that this is a book about innovation policy. I think the health of our democracies depend on getting this more right than wrong. So how well do I think the UK is placed? And I'd be really interested in the discussion to hear others' views. So my fear is that the UK is currently poorly placed on this agenda because it's far too centralised as a country. Local government has been stripped bare, affecting its ability to act as a place leader. And I see this repeatedly in one of my roles as on the board of the High Streets Task Force, which is a government-backed entity that's set up to help town centres and high streets transform in the face of online retail and now COVID. So the need for strong local leadership to create a meaningful vision for how a town centre evolves is often missing because the depth and strength of local government has been significantly eroded. And at regional level, the leash from central government is often too short, with relatively short-term funding settlements riven with uncertainty. I thought it was interesting that a report published by the British Academy last week that I'm sure many of you about how to rebuild post-COVID highlighted the need for a new settlement between the different levels of government in the UK and a really strong need to push power down towards the local level. And as I said at the beginning, my sense from the book was that locally held power, local decision-making was critical really to enabling innovation policy to lead to the right kind of growth for particular places. And I worry that the UK in its current form is going to struggle to do that. And I think for me, we see that reflected in the current approach to levelling up you know, a vast number of relatively short-term funds that are held by Whitehall that local areas have to compete for, which I think sort of fly in the face of what I take from Dan's book, which is the need for a much more strategic, longer-term approach to how to create growth in places that is very much rooted in the assets of that place, the identity and the heritage of that place, and taking that forward. So really huge congratulations to Dan on a brilliant book, which I really enjoyed reading, and really look forward to others' assessments of the challenges here in the UK for taking this kind of agenda forward. Thank you.
Your wonderful stuff. Thank you very much. I enjoyed that. I think we will go to David now, and then I will give Dan a chance to respond to both discussants afterwards, if that's okay. So, David?
I'd like to start off by saying a few things directly about the book. I've tried very much to keep up with this literature on innovation. I think it's very central. And in that light, I want to say, I think this is the most insightful study which I have read on contemporary innovation. I think it will have a very big impact, and I hope that people will absorb the key lessons of the book, that institutions are complementary. You need to have an ecosystem, in other words, which works together. Individual flashy solutions, like, I don't know, a particular form of venture capitalism, or just concentrating on university research, don't make sense by themselves, and maybe don't make sense anyway. That I very much like Dan's insistence that we're interested in innovation and not invention. And I found very useful and thought-provoking the idea of his four different stages, and I want to come back to them later. I'd say I've learnt a huge amount from Dan's earlier books on the really understanding about Taiwan, Ireland, and Israel was a real eye-opener to me. Also the Red Queen's race, which really made me start reading a lot more about China. And I detect with great pleasure the influence of John Zeisman, one of my oldest friends, in fact, and one of the greatest political economists, in my view, of the last, well, 4 or 5 decades. So just to repeat, I think this is a major book, and a book which is going to have a lot of influence. Now, the UK doesn't appear in the book or hardly. And of course, just sort of echoing Vidya, the what's happening in the UK is obviously a matter of huge and problematic importance for us. The low level of productivity, the low level of productivity growth, inequality, and so on and so forth. If one asks exactly why this has come about, I suppose the most obvious thing to say is, as we all know and was implied by what Vidya was saying, is this division between the South and the rest of at least England. And what I would take as a starting point, because I think this is actually very important, is to ask, why is it that the South is doing as well as it is. When I say the South, I mean largely London, and I mean definitely excluding the area, excluding a large chunk of East London, and the area too, a lot of the area to the east of London. The whole M4 corridor, Bristol, Reading, Oxford, Cambridge, Brighton, all centered around London, is a, I would say, a success story. Leave aside the inequality, but success story. And in terms of German Länder, it's not up to Baden-Württemberg or Bavaria, but it's up to quite big chunks of North Rhine-Westphalia. So I think we need to at least understand why that has done so well, and to ask whether that has lessons for the north of England. And I have to say, I'm really, really unclear about these answers. So it was very interesting listening to, I found it very interesting listening to Vidya, I have to say. What is the success of this area, which many of us live in, London and maybe some of the area to the on the M4 corridor and so on? First of all, I don't think it's stage three, as in Germany, and we can come back to that. That's to say, stage three in Germany is really the superb way, for instance, in which the auto industry works in Germany, though of course it's going through massive, massive rethinking about how it works at the moment. But I don't think that's remotely ways of organizing ourselves which we are capable of. The German economy works in a fundamentally different way to the way we work in terms of labor markets, in terms of finance, in terms of the coordination across businesses and so on and so forth. I think we need to put that on one side, just as actually I think we need to put Taiwan, marvelous, marvelous, marvelous though Taiwan is in the way in which it's organized. These are not countries which we can remotely hope to copy, at least in my view. Why is London so successful? Well, the first and most straightforward reason is it rests on high value-added services of various sorts, largely in the private sector. And these are highly educated people, mainly graduates, who work in, number one, obviously the city and the financial sector. Number two, and it's forgotten very often just how important this is, the law, the legal sector. Number three, the whole sectors of accountancy, management consultancy, and we could go beyond that, insurance, and also from that, advertising, media and culture. These are all hugely successful sectors in largely in London and in the associated South. I would argue that these are actually highly innovative sectors. We don't think of them like that because we don't think of innovation in that sort of way. In fact, the only parts of those sectors which would come into, which we would think of as innovative in a remotely, say, stage one way, is fintech. There are a few other sectors like fintech, but by and large, these are sectors. If you take company law in London, this is a massively innovative, clever people finding clever solutions, which of course benefit largely private profits in one form or another. But this is a whole set of innovative innovative sectors which produce very high incomes for the people who work in them. Now, in part, this works because it's highly attractive to multinationals, not just UK, but actually larger foreign multinationals, to be able to set up their either European or their international headquarters, or certainly their UK headquarters in London, because what they need is very ready, continuing access to all these very high value-added services, where you can put groups of people in the different services together to work out the complex solutions which your corporation needs. So this works. I mean, it works, to come back to what Dan was saying about the inequality of places like Silicon Valley. This works in a pretty inegalitarian way. And one major problem, which I guess I would have, is we just don't tax the people who work in these sectors in remotely a sensible way. And if I was pushing this a bit further, again, in relation to London, I would say that one of the things, if we're looking at the future, actually this applies to the American labor market data as well. If we look at the future, what we can see over the next 10 years is the really big expanding areas are actually going to be health, medicine, and education. Those are the areas which we should be really putting very able people into. And one major way in which I would see things changing is where you actually redistribute quite a lot of money to build up serious incomes for people who work in those areas in education and health. And I would also add to that, and this is a Scandinavian lesson, I'd also add to that the care sectors, that we have in my view, outrageous attitude towards old age care in this country. There is anyway a future which is a pretty prosperous future along those grounds. I also like to,
David, I'm just going to give you one more minute.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't. Well, let me just finish by saying, I actually do think that big cities are where our future lies. That's it. I don't think Bolton or Wigan or Oldham. I do think Manchester, and I do think, to come back to what Vidya was saying, I do think the future lies in city regions, where city regions are given a great deal of autonomy to develop their own solutions. Do you want me to stop now, Neil? Very happy to do.
I think I want to leave plenty of time for questions, because we've had loads of good questions. Good. But first of all, I want to give Dan, so everyone can switch their cameras on. If we give Dan a right to respond to these vicious critiques of your work.
I'll take those kinds of vicious critiques any day. So first, thank you. I will say the first thing that I would suggest that we do is to start to think, when we devise innovation policies, the first basic things we should do is to start thinking about the distribution of outcomes. And if we do that, we should immediately realize that things, for example, the venture capital model, the American venture capital model, assuming you're successful, would end with horrific inequality, which somebody asked me, I think, in one of the questions that I saw is about Silicon Valley. Just think about this model for example. It used to be a reasonable model for local innovation-based growth when you had the manufacturing, like Apple did for a very long period of time in California. But when you don't, what you really have in the venture capital model is a group of five people that gets a huge amount of money on the assumption that they will run as fast as they can into a financial exit. And in the financial exit, the people who will win a lot of money are insiders of Wall Street, the venture capitalist, and those five people, right? The aim of venture capital, for those of you who don't know, is to basically gamble on companies. They have 5 to 7 years, more or less, to reach a financial exit, where a financial exit is one of two types. I sell my company to a bigger company or I go IPO. I no longer care, and as a matter of fact, I don't want to even deal with any other activities but the R&D and maybe a little bit of a sales. Run we go to the lottery system. So if this sounds like a lottery system, it is a lottery system, and it involves two things. The people who are in the lottery system get really decent wages. You know, Silicon Valley engineers are very well paid, and their financiers are very well paid. And if we are successful, again, not in growing a massive company with a lot of jobs, just with a financial exit, they become millionaires. Who is allowed to inside this lottery systems? The graduate of Stanford, Berkeley, MIT. Not exactly the people that I should worry about, because if you finish an engineering at MIT, you're pretty well set for life. And yet, we have financial regulation after financial regulation after financial regulation that first allowed this model to succeed and then making it happen. And that has become even more and more and more nutty when the financial markets and Wall Street change. And right now you can't go IPO unless you're several billions, because there's only 4 or 5 investment bankers and underwriters, and they are not interested in transactions that are not at least 2 billions. So you have a secondary market in unicorn shares in which those people, the insiders, get richer and richer, and the rest of society, and we should have realized it in advance. So one of the things we could do is to create financial vehicles. And throughout the history of the Industrial Revolution, as David knows very well, speaking about Germany, for example, or France, we had other venture financing instead of venture capital tools in order to allow the people with ideas to make them into innovation. And not all of them were basically, paraphrase one of my heroes, Suzanne Strange, casino capitalism going full tilt. So that's one of the things that I will say. And as of now, there is zero discussions about it. So I would strongly urge to have a discussion about it. The second, which I think is about the smaller community, and I've seen a lot of comments about that. First of all, I want to make it very clear, not everybody can or should imitate Silicon Valley. And once you realize that, you realize that what globalization has allowed you to do is a significantly larger array of ways to interact with a global economy. From, you know, high-end innovation, that's fine. By the way, you don't have to do it in venture capital-based mode versus others, to production. And the real question that you then need to think about, if you're Grimsby or, as I said, Hamilton or Sudbury, if anyone know Ontario, or even Baltimore, by the way, which is not doing very well, is figuring out what current innovation capacities you have. So instead of thinking, and that's, by the way, a long problem of the English innovation policies, instead of thinking about it as an industry as if we're still in the 70s, what set of activities, whether it's textile or it's space, aerospace, what is actually going to happen in your locale? And how are you going to excel in that stage, no matter what industry it is, right? And I would urge you to do that. One last point about the wonderful UK innovation policy. I have a running joke with my friends and the various agencies. Every time they call me, I ask them if the name of our agency is still the same or has been already changed. Because I can't keep up with the names that your parliament give your agencies, nor how it is being cut and spaced. I have no clue how companies and entrepreneurs should keep up with this. And who should they call? Because every 3 years, you change your whole system. If you want to actually succeed in innovation in the UK, it would be nice to actually have some resiliency and sustainment with your innovation agencies and policies. But I'll stop being cynical on your expense now.
Wonderful. Thank you. I don't know if David or Vijay, you want to say anything at this point, or we can move on to questions. Okay, so I'm going to start off with a few questions about innovation, actually. So Lugla Land's got a wonderful question about, is it more important to have to be producing the cutting edge research, or is it more important to be, you know, having a share, you know, using the proceeds of that, using the technologies, using the sort of, you know, science. Jingyuan Zhang, he suggested, what about the sort of balance of sort of local or sort of, you know, national knowledge? Does it matter, you know, if you, he's, so Jingyuan, for the, you know, is actually, we know him very well. He's an expert in Shenzhen. And he talks about for Huawei, most of the cutting edge 5G patents are essentially published or announced with overseas universities, but they exploit it locally. So sort of, I guess for Dan and David, that's particularly a question. But then I had a third question about innovation, which is going back to sort of, you know, Vijay's point, which is about sort of social innovation. And one of the things you don't talk about in the book is sort of social and sort of social innovation in various forms. So, in particular, I'm interested in sort of Vijay's and David's as well. But your points on whether, you know, where do they do that well? Where's the sort of Taiwan of sort of social innovation would be an interesting question for me. So I'll start off with Dan, and then go to Vijay, and then David, if that's okay. You're on mute.
Yeah. So first of all, I should unmute myself. Second, yes, that's exactly what has changed. And what has changed is that we have now a global system where innovation can be translated into, invention can be translated to innovation anywhere. Where I do the high-end innovation does not mean that the fruit of the success will happen. Huawei is a wonderful example, and it's exactly that. But the reason Huawei and Shenzhen are so successful is indeed not that they do those high-end patents, but they are the area and the companies that know how to take those patents and actually use them. And they use them very well. So for example, Huawei has been unbelievably successful in getting the things that Canadians don't seem to be doing, and that is making very high-end Canadian innovation into things. Just look at the in fifth generation mobile telephony, just go and look how many of offers of Huawei's patents are Canadian. And then go and watch how many Canadian telecommunication companies managed to be successful around the same invention. And the answer is almost zero. And that's the world we live in. So the question for me is, if you're a local leader, how can you become the area that can utilize all those global buzz and make it local? Not necessarily be the area in which, yeah, people like me and my friends can come up with wonderful ideas in my university lab, and there'll be absolutely zero local economic growth out of this. In terms of social innovation, as Neil knows, I wrote a lot about social innovation, but not in this book on purpose. So I'll let other people answer that.
Vijay, do you want to come in at this point?
Yeah, so having not read what Dan's written on social innovation, I don't know if I'm interpreting social innovation in quite the same way as he might, but I suppose when I think about places that are taking a more inclusive approach, that are innovating both economically and socially, actually one of the things they often have in common is remoteness. So you see really interesting models of socially driven innovation to create more inclusive economic forms in Scotland, in the Highlands. You see the same on some of the islands in Canada. So I'm kind of worked quite a bit recently with Zeta Cobb and Fogo Island in Newfoundland, really interesting models there, and their remoteness drives a need to do things differently. I think what could be interesting is how you capture some of the essence of that in places that don't have that remoteness. So I think one of the things those places do well is they think, exactly as Dan said early on, they think about the outcomes that they're trying to achieve. I think what we don't, what we do less well on in mainland kind of countries is go through that thought process. So when I think about a place like Grimsby, and sorry, somebody in the audience is from Grimsby, and I apologize for picking on Grimsby, but we've been working there for the last 5 years. You know, it's exploiting one of the assets that it has, which is offshore wind. But at the moment, it's not doing enough, I don't think, to connect that potential growth area into the rest of its community, who actually are at risk of not benefiting at all from the growth that might come from the offshore wind. So what else is there in, you know, what kind of concept of growth does Grimsby want going forward? How can it connect that to the widest possible number of people in the local area? And how can it think about the kinds of activities that that might support growth to reach into those disadvantaged communities that are otherwise going to be left behind? So I think there's stuff that we can learn from some of those more remote communities that are doing things, kind of combining economic and social innovation in quite a different way, and bring that into more traditional thinking.
Wonderful, thank you. David, do you want to take up some of those points, particularly about sort of innovation and the...
Okay, very quick. What I think worries me most about the social side of things from a slightly longer term perspective is we live in a country in the UK where half young people go to university and half don't. And we also know that people go to university, although there are problems at the lower end of that, have really vastly better lives than people who don't go to university. And that, from a long-term perspective, seems to me a massive problem. So it's very interesting working, so I work a lot on Southern Germany, on Baden-Württemberg, Bavaria. Very interesting working on Germany, where the Germans have radically reduced, top German colleges, radically reduced apprenticeships. And in place of apprenticeships, young people now go to what they call University of Applied Science, which are three-year universities, but instead of being very, very theoretical, they're much more linked into the type of actual research problems which companies have. So they're set up on a much more local basis than sort of top universities would be, but they're very closely linked into the employers in those areas, and there's a symbiotic relationship in terms of research which goes from the universities to the companies, and from the companies to the universities, giving young people paths into good employment. And this increasingly is all very much linked to the huge increase in women going to university. And I think one of the things one wants to say about this whole world we live in is it has led to, with all the qualifications, it's led to an extraordinary increase in gender autonomy and the types of careers which women now have. So I go back and work on the 1960s and 1970s, and I'm just hugely aware we've gone through this massive social revolution. And it's particularly interesting in Germany, where Germans have not been the most advanced people in this respect traditionally, but that is now beginning to change. So I see this question of how you build in university education combined with the type of graduate jobs which those who get university education can go into, and how you gradually increase the percentage of people who go into university in that sort of way. Now, just one very, very quick thing. My own view is, as I said, there are three huge areas which need highly educated people. One is education itself, schools. The second is the whole health service and how that works, doctors and everything else, doctors and nurses. And the third is the care sector, where I think we are going to come around more and more to understand we actually need to have people who have got very good education who are in the care sector, and not as in this country, where that's not the case. So I see these as the areas we should be going in. I think Germany is a good country to look at, because Germans think about these things really very carefully, and I don't think we do. So
wonderful. So I'm just going to take a couple of questions from the audience. And the first one is Alex Gibbs, who's one of my students. And he's asked a thinly disguised version of the essay question I set him. So he's asked, how would you address issues such as inequality in established innovation areas such as Silicon Valley? So give an answer to that, but not too good an answer to that, please. Then Jinguan's asked, is it possible that inequality might be the cause rather than the consequence of sort of technological change? Which is, I think, a sort of nice question. So, Dan, if we kick off with you, if that's okay.
Sure. So, you want a really, really bad answer for the first and a good answer for the second. I actually think it's seriously speaking, the places that I have looked upon and very worryingly about the growing inequality and innovation are indeed Silicon Valley. Let's just move it slightly bigger, but various places in the US and less so in Canada. We can talk about it later, why less so in Canada. Tel Aviv. And there are various ways that they have tried to do that. By the way, nothing is being tried in Silicon Valley, okay? Let's just be very clear, they just couldn't care. One of the most horrific examples that I and some of our co-authors I had when we interviewed a VC, a very successful VC in Silicon Valley, and asked him what will be the future for the people who are not R&D engineers, he specifically states, without even thinking that he's a horrific human being, says, well, they can replace the Mexican workers working in my vineyard. And that's his vision for around 90% of the US population. So don't assume everything good will happen from Silicon Valley. But what you can do is start to think about how do you diffuse innovation throughout the economy in ways that really enabled people with different kinds of skills to work and be more productive instead of basically replacing them. I just spent the whole morning, Neil, you'll probably find it riveting, talking about the trucking industry, you know, long haul trucking in the US. People think that the real problem is autonomous cars. That's actually not a real big problem of the truckers. The real problem of the truckers with all those technologies of half AI or autonomous cars and unbelievable surveillance, which basically make truckers look like Amazon delivery associates, I think they're called. So we don't give them benefits. They're called associates, I think. And that's a real problem. A lot of a problem in those places is there is zero thinking about how innovation can revitalize sectors and occupations that employ people who are not R&D engineers, who don't look like the Silicon Valley insiders. There is all the financial and taxation incentives to devise, to take technologies that can actually really help workers become more productive and instead focus on replacing the workers and actually making those jobs more and more stupid so you can hire people who don't have any kind of education. I hope that's good enough for both you and Neil. Can you remind me what was the second question? Sorry, Neil.
So the second question, is it possible inequality is the sort of cause rather than the consequence? And he's basically saying that, you know, if you look at, you know, some countries, you sort of develop your core regions to build up national champions and
So that's actually, so just if that's what you do, you are creating inequalities by, for maybe for a good reasons, but that's what you just did. So I would say that no, I think it really, you have a choice. And you could see it. I mean, David talks about Germany, so I'll not mention Germany, but you can go from Finland, which was a really, excuse my language, unbelievably primitive society that completely depended on bilateral trade with the USSR. If you even remember what it was, it's called Communist Soviet Union. To the level that they were basically taking trees, giving them to Russia, and Russia gave them oil, and that was the most sophisticated stuff in the economy. Their central banker once said that Finland should not export anything smaller from a horse. And within 15 years, they had Nokia, who was, by the way, doing boots and paper, becoming one of the most sophisticated telecommunication companies. And the country actually stayed egalitarian. You had Taiwan, which I already talked about. And on the other hand, then you had, you know, I harap on Tel Aviv to no end. So let me talk about South Korea, which people think is a wonderful miracle. It's a horrific inequality with all the people, suicide rate, I think, is now number one in the world. And it was a lot more equal before the financial crisis of 97, when we basically forced the South Korea to adhere to our I would say, American and London, the city of financial regulation and how you do corporate governance. So I would say that inequality is not what is driven innovation. The question is, how do you incentivize innovation? And remember, innovation is the act, it's not the invention. So it will create more or less equality in your society.
It's great. I'm gonna, so we're running out of time, so I'm just gonna add in a question before going to Vijay, David and Dan, which is, so Johnny Ross Tatum has got a great question here about Grimsby. And so the question is, I mean, it's quite broad, you know, with the right local powers, what kind of practical policies could create more good jobs in post-industrial times, towns like Grimsby, in a way that doesn't increase inequality? Which seems like a sort of, you know, important question. So I don't know if Vijay or David, do you want to have a go at that first? Or David?
You're giving that to me, David.
Yes, I have, absolutely. That's obvious, as my grandson would say.
Okay, so I'll have a go. I mean, these aren't easy questions, but I think the starting point is what the point that Dan made, which is, what are your current innovation capacities? So I think that's what that's where we rarely do a good job of actually thinking about what could you do in that place? What are its assets? What's its heritage? What could you build from what's there? We often think about, I mean, I get very frustrated with listening to local authority chief execs, regional, you know, combined authority senior people talking about the number of millions they will pay Amazon to come and site its warehouse in their area. So, you know, £5 million incentives to actually get an Amazon warehouse in the area. I think the future of Grimsby is to grow from within. So I think local, if you had greater local powers, it'd be about assessing, I think the starting point has to be assessing what's actually there, what can you build from, what's the state of the small businesses there, what could you nurture, it has the huge asset of a short, you know, the coast. What can you do with that? And I think that's the starting point. I also think there's a much more activist role for the state to play in terms of how it procures, how it employs, you know, what can it do as an engine of growth locally? So I think some combination of those things. But I also wanted to pick up two points from the discussion so far. I mean, one, I think David's point about social care is really interesting, and I hope that that's the case. But thinking about innovation in these sectors like social care that we just pay no attention to economically. We just don't think of them as economic sectors, but they employ huge numbers of women in particular. And if we gave as much thought to social care and those kinds of sectors, the foundation economy sectors, as we give to, you know, VC-backed sectors, we'd be a lot better off, I think, particularly in some of these communities where growth has been a struggle. And the other point is around long-termism. I mean, everything that Dan has criticized about the VC culture, it, you know, partly stems from a kind of a short-termism, and everything I think that we've discussed that's positive in this conversation is about the need to take a longer term view. But I think that is also fundamentally challenging in the way in which the UK in particular is currently operating. But we need to think about this as generational change in terms of how we turn some of these places like Grimsby around. It's not something that's going to happen in 5 years. So a very short-termist approach. You know, we need to think about a decade, 15 years, as the Nokia example sort of suggests, rather than something that's going to turn around too quickly.
Wonderful. David?
Neil, can I very, very quickly just come back to the care sector? There are massive innovations going on about how care can work. They need to have very well-educated carers doing them. And that's not the way the system works at the moment in this country at all. So I'm sort of talking a bit more about this country. It's really, really worth going to Sweden and seeing how this works there. This is a different system. This says to look after older people, you need to have highly intelligent workers to do it, because all sorts of innovations are taking place which need to have really well-educated people to operate. So that's something I also happen to think, that we need to educate old people better. That old people should be far more autonomous, actually, in looking, in running their own lives. At the moment, we as if we treat them as sort of patients who can't do anything, and they get looked after by carers who are not very well educated. And that's something which I see as that requires a long-term solution. It also requires, it's a public good, it requires a government to actually do things, to change things in that sort of way. So that'd be my, but can I just end up by really thanking Dan so much for this, and lovely listening to Vija as well. And I want to really sort of get into some of the things you're doing. So thank you very, very much.
Well, David, I've actually got one more question for Dan, right, which is that we've got a load of UK civil servants, I've noticed, in the participants. So yeah. What's your one very, we've got like a minute left, so what's your like one quick message for the UK policymakers from the book?
Sure. Don't change your policies every 3 years. No, it's really important. It's very important to experiment. It's very important to scale up the experimentation. But you have clients, which are the entrepreneurs and companies. It takes about 2 to 3 years that they even know what is the new policies. Then around 1 to 3 years until you and they together actually figure out how to make that policy as efficient it can be. When you change everything, including your name, every 3 to 4 years, it's great to experiment over time, but there will be zero scale up and almost no impact. The second, don't do VC. Think about debt and scale up, not just financial exit. That's it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. So look, David, thank you very much. Vidya, thank you so much. Welcome back to the LSE. We hope we can invite you to many more of these, speak at many more of these things. And Dan, congratulations on the book. Thank you very much for speaking back, talking about it. It sounds wonderful. I look forward to reading a hard copy. I'm lucky enough that I've read a sort of electronic copy. Thank you very much, all of you. And thank you very much to everyone for attending. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thank you so much, LSE. Thank you so much, Vida and David.